I went into that school to integrate it. I went in so that I would have the same rights as any other child. Before that day, November 14, 1960, I didn't have the right to choose my own school.
Welcome to On the Porch with Rose Stuckey Kirk. That's me. I've learned that remarkable conversations with interesting people can happen in the simplest of places, whether it's a balcony, deck, patio, stoop, or a porch. Thank you for joining me as we talk with leaders and experts about issues that affect all of us. My guest today is someone I've admired for many years. When you think about the tipping points in history, the moments that forever changed our nation and still resonate with us today, she immediately pops into your head. She is a civil rights icon, author, speaker, and activist. It is my pleasure and honor to welcome Ruby Bridges to the porch. Ruby, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited.
I'm so happy to hear that. So we are both little women and girls of the South and therefore of the porch. And I believe that great conversations have happened there. So talk to me a little bit about, you know, your awareness of key conversations in your life that happened on your porch.
Well, when I think about the porch, even though I actually grew up with a front porch, I think about not New Orleans, but Mississippi and my grandparents, because I spent every summer on the farm that my grandparents actually sharecropped on for almost 25 years. And because I would gather there every summer with all of my cousins, I come from a very large family, and it was always activity and conversation on the porch. That's where they would sit and shell peas and do all of their canning on the front porch. And it would, you know, it was always my aunts and uncle and my grandmother. So definitely I am a product of the front porch.
I love it. I love it. I love the fact that everything was happening there because my great-grandparents had a Victorian house and a wraparound porch. And I remember as a little girl just sitting there and enjoying, you know, listening to the adults problem solve. I was so fascinated about how their hands could move so fast shelling peas while they also could solve some of the biggest issues in society. So I think we have some great common memories there. And it leads me to wonder, you know, what were the porch conversations when your parents were thinking about having you at the age of six integrate William France Elementary School there in New Orleans? I mean, this probably lives in your heart every day. You probably have a lot of memories of some of those conversations, particularly now that it's November 14th. It's the 61st anniversary of that historic day. Were both of your parents supportive of this incredible step that a six-year-old was going to take that would change the nation?
Well, they were at odds a little bit about it. My father fought in the Korean War, and he was both of them were very young. And my father had received a Purple Heart. He was injured and managed to carry his fellow soldier back, had both of his legs blown off from this injury. And my father carried him back, and he was awarded a Purple Heart for that. But I remember my father saying that sending me to this white school wouldn't change anything, because after he got back from the service, that, you know, he would always say that he was still just a colored soldier, that you could be fighting next to a white soldier, and when it was your turn to go onto the front line, you could be in the same foxhole with a white soldier. But if you lived, at the end of the day, you could not go back to the same barracks together, and you could not eat in the same mess hall. And so he felt like, why send me to the school? Because things did not change for him once he returned home, and he didn't feel like things would change for me. And he didn't want to jeopardize his child to what could happen. And my mother was a little bit different. You know, my mother didn't experience the same things that he did. She didn't see some of the things that he saw, you know, at war. My mother only was focused on the fact that she could not go to school, that when it was time for them to get the crops in, that was far more important than their education. And so she wanted better opportunities for herself and for her children. And so, you know, like most women, she convinced him. I always say, you know, women can be very persuasive. And so they eventually agreed. And there I was, you know, going into a new school.
So there you were, a six-year-old, right, carrying a little bit of the responsibility of your parents' dreams or your parents' perspective into this big moment to integrate a school. Could you even talk about this monumental event at home, given that your parents had different perspectives on it?
No, not really. As a matter of fact, I really don't remember myself and my parents having a conversation about what was about to take place. And, you know, in hindsight, being a parent myself now and a grandparent, I think their decision not to sit me down and to explain to me what I was about to venture into was probably the smartest approach, because the only thing that they ever said was, Ruby, you're going to go to a new school today and you better behave. And I have to tell you, I was more focused on behaving than what, you know, was about to take place. I never even knew that I was going into a white school. That was not something that they revealed to me. They only said, you're going to go to a new school. So I never really had an opportunity to really sit down and discuss it with them. Definitely they would ask me, you know, how do you like your new school? I remember my father asking me that, and, you know, I would tell him that I really liked it. And I did. I loved school, and the fact that, you know, I had an incredible teacher who filled my day with things to do to keep my mind off of what was happening outside of the school. I knew that if I just got, you know, out of the car, past that crowd outside, and into my classroom, that I was going to have a great day. Mm-hmm. And so I was so excited about going to school every day. Yes, nervous about that short walk through the mob of people, but I knew that I was going to have a great day, and it was because of Mrs. Henry, who was my teacher.
Mm-hmm. So here's what's interesting to me. You know, it's November 14th, it's 61 years later. You were walking through crowds of angry people yelling disparaging, negative comments at you, angry about the situation. And fast forward today, for various reasons, we're seeing similar activity as little kids are going to school, walking through angry crowds. What does this mean to you that we appear to be in this continuous state of history repeating itself? Does it make you ask yourself if what you did was real, if what you did had an impact? Help me understand.
No, I absolutely feel that what I did had a huge impact on education today. I didn't realize that growing up, but definitely, because you have to, you know, acknowledge and understand that I went into that school to integrate it. I went in so that I would have the same rights as any other child. Before that day, November 14, 1960, I didn't have the right to choose my own schools. And so to dismiss the sacrifices that so many people made so that I would be able to have the right to attend that school. I mean, we have to think about not just my parents and the sacrifices that they made, but Thurgood Marshall and all of his colleagues that fought so hard to have that law changed. We can't dismiss that. Definitely I know that what I did made a huge difference because now we have the right to choose our own schools. Now, whether or not we are accepted the way that we should be, that's an altogether different issue. But truly, it was worth it. And definitely, it made things better. It is unfortunate that it seems that we are repeating history all over again. But, I honestly feel like for a very, very long time, after the loss of Dr. King, who fought so hard for so many of those rights, that somehow another, that generation after losing him, I think we somehow didn't pass those values on. I often say today I am so excited that young people now feel like activism is cool again. I spend so much time talking to kids all across the country, schools, and now I do it virtually, where, they want to know. They want to know their history. They want to know how they too can get involved. They're talking about protesting. And so I do believe that, if we're going to get past our racial differences, that it will come from young people. And let's face it, there were so many young people who were involved during the civil rights movement, who not only marched but filled the jails. And so, it's exciting that, today we see that young people are more engaged and feel like that they too want to make a difference to try and make things better. So it's a constant fight. I don't think that we will ever be able to just rest and think that things are going to be perfect, because I don't feel that way. I feel like it is going to be a constant struggle for us.
But what's interesting, for you and your journey, though, is that while this happened to you at six, when you were a teenager, you didn't at first realize exactly the monumental impact that you had had. I think it was when you saw the Norman Rockwell painting, The Problem We All Live With, that really is a iconic image of the civil rights movement, and it's really you. That yes. A reporter knocked on your door and made you aware that was you, that image. And talk to me about that. How did you make that connection between being an activist that you are today and embracing what really happened or not fully understanding it when you were growing up?
Well, after that first year, after the crowds had given up and they left, I think they realized that I wasn't giving up and my parents wasn't. And so by the time I went into second grade, pretty much that whole integration process was over. I no longer had to be escorted by federal marshals. The school was then filled with kids, about 500 kids that school held. It was still predominantly white, but there were a handful of other black kids in my class for second grade. And at that point, parents could go to pretty much any school in the city and register their child, because at that point, schools across the city was integrated. They were integrated then. So it was over, pretty much, And I remember thinking that because I sort of expected the year, the following year for second grade, to be the same as first grade was, but it was different. It was over. I think the task was completed and no one talked about it. Because it was such a touchy subject in my own household, my parents didn't really talk about it. And I remember there were times, you know, I actually thought, well, did I dream this? You know, I knew that it happened, but it seemed to be swept under the rug and no one wanted to discuss it. I'm thinking that probably it was such a black eye for the city because the whole world pretty much watched what happened to the six-year-old. And so people in the city didn't really want to talk about it. It wasn't like I could go back to school and open up my history book and read about myself and that incident. Definitely that was not the case. You know, history books did not even talk about, you know, African Americans and any contributions that they had made. So that didn't happen for a very, very long time. We didn't have Black History Month, so it wasn't like I would have, you know, learned anything there. So it was over. And yes, it did haunt me because you have to understand that I had all of these memories and yet it was like it didn't happen at all.
Did any of that impact your mental health, though? You have these memories. You were 6 years old. I'm sure some of it was uncomfortable. Were you haunted in any way by it?
I think I was. You know, I probably was not aware of it at the time. But, you know, one of the things that bothered me when you talk about haunted by it is that the crowd would bring this baby's coffin and they put a black doll inside of the coffin and they would march around the school. Now, whenever I remember being frightened, it was whenever I had to pass the coffin. You know, that would just pretty much scare me to death and I would have nightmares about it for a very, very long time. So yes, it haunted me, I would have to say. I remember also getting boxes and boxes of mail from people all across the world. And those boxes would stay up in the attic. And in 1965, when Hurricane Betsy hit, you know, all of that was destroyed. But I remember before that happened, I would go up and, you know, open up these letters and read them. And, you know, that was sort of what made it real for me, mm-hmm. being able to do that. But by the time I got into high school, about 17 years old, a reporter came to ask me to do an interview. And yes, he showed me the Norman Rockwell painting. And that was the first time that I'd seen it. And he said, "Are you aware that this is you? It depicts your walk into William France School." And at that moment, I remember looking at it, and I feel like it confirmed for me that this wasn't just something that happened on my street. It wasn't something that just happened in my community, that it was a part of a much bigger movement, and that it actually changed the face of education across the country. I did not realize that until that moment when I saw it. And I think, you know, in hindsight, it helped me to understand how important my role was in that movement and that I was a part of a much bigger family, this mm-hmm. civil rights family that I wasn't aware of.
Mm-hmm. And that painting, you know, actually hung in the White House. And it's
yes.
probably the first time that the N-word, right, which is on the wall in that painting, you can see that, was in the White House. It was during President Barack Obama's administration. And you were there for the unveiling of that. Tell me
yes.
what happened, what that meant to you.
Well, you know, it was, I can't remember exactly what year, but we were celebrating again, November the 14th. And I was thinking about it. And, you know, because I've spent so much time all across the country with a huge fan base of kids. I wanted to commemorate that day not just locally, but I wanted to do it on a national level. And because I sit on the Norman Rockwell board, we discussed it, and I thought, you know, how cool would it be if we could, you know, have the painting hung at the White House, because the painting actually travels more than I do. And, you know, it has a very busy schedule. And so we talked about it, and we started to write letters and have other people write letters to President Obama. And I figured that if any president would hang it at the White House, it would be him. And sure enough, he did. And, you know, I received a phone call inviting me to come for the unveiling of it and to see it. And I was so excited. I mean, definitely excited to meet this, you know, African-American president, but also to see this painting hang in the White House. And it was definitely an amazing visit. Mm-hmm. And I was extremely proud of the fact that, you know, we all had something to do with it, you know, hanging there for during his administration.
Yeah. And I think there's a couple of things, right? I mean, the White House has the best porches, right? That portico.
Yes.
Yes. Having been there as well. And then that beautiful hall of portraits is almost mind-blowing. And to think that your journey, you know, and when you were 6 years old, what was a part of that, that had to really be remarkable. And did that, and I think it happened back in 2011. So did that sort of bring you to a place of really thinking about, you know, this view of how we have to understand where we came from in order to think about how we move forward? Because that was a full circle moment for you. And you talk a lot about that, that you cannot, I think one of your quotes is that we cannot prepare any one person to meet the challenges and conditions of their world if we falsify the history they are taught. What does that mean to you?
Absolutely, because, you know, I feel like, well, you know, if you think about what we just talked about, you know, here I was a part of a movement that I thought just happened on my street and in my community, people not really talking about it. So in hindsight, I didn't really know who I was. I didn't know the importance of that walk because no one talked to me about it. For years, you know, it was brushed under the rug. So not until I actually saw the painting did I realize how important my role was. It helped to shape me into who I am today. And so when we think about how important our history is, what if I'd not ever come into that realization, you know, that I didn't, I mean, definitely, you know, as an adult, probably I would have understood. But, you know, after 17, if that had not happened for me, you know, maybe I wouldn't have realized just how important my role was and that, you know, what the next steps would have been for me. You do have to know your history to pretty much know where you're going. And that happened for me. And so I think that in my mind, history is sacred and that none of us really have the right to change or alter that history in any way. So when we tell half the story or leave out portions of it, aren't we really lying? I mean, we're not telling the whole truth. We're not painting an accurate picture of what actually happened even before we got here. And, you know, today, young people are far too smart, you know, whether we tell them the truth or not. I mean, they have so much information right at their fingertips that they can research it. That wasn't something that I could do back then. But in a second, they can research and find pretty much the truth. We have museums that do the work of making sure that we have images that we can see and that paints a picture for us and tells us the truth. And so I don't quite understand why we are still using obsolete textbooks, that there are groups of people who feel like we need to leave out certain portions of history. I mean, who are we really fooling here? I can tell you it's not our kids. It's not young people. You're not fooling them at all or pulling the wall over their eyes. You know, they are smart enough to seek out the truth. And you know what? When we think about those conversations on the porch, definitely, you know, I would hear all the time on the porch, the truth will set you free. And it will.
Yeah, because the freedom that it gives you is exactly what you talked about, Ruby, is a sense of self. That when you know your history, your people's history, when you know the contributions that you've made, it gives you confidence and it gives you that sense of who you are and who you're going to be. Talk to me a little bit about at 17, when that became your reality, did it change your personal journey and the path that you wanted to take and what you wanted to do with this incredible impact you had had on the world?
Well, it definitely helped me to understand that, you know, I am someone special. I didn't realize that, or I should say that it made me feel like I was someone special and that, you know, I played a major role in something that was very important in the country. And I think that helped me. I wasn't a very confident child growing up, but that definitely helped some. My years after high school, I really didn't understand how to go and enroll myself into college, and it wasn't like my parents were educated enough to really help me with that process. And all I could focus on at that point was, how am I going to get out of this small community? That I felt like there was definitely something more out there that I wanted to see and wanted to be a part of. And surely my experience as a six-year-old opened my eyes to that. You know, it was almost like I'd seen a glimpse of it, and then pretty much it was shut down because nobody talked about it. And yet I'd already seen it, and I wanted more. So all I could focus on is thinking about, how am I going to get outside of this community? And so I applied for business school to study travel and tourism, landed a job with American Express, where I worked for them for about 15, 16 years. It afforded me the opportunity to travel abroad extensively. And I went to places that I would never been able to afford to visit and see. So it really opened up the wider world for me. And it was like, you know, I remember thinking to myself, I was right. There's so much more, you know. And I just felt a sense of freedom and that I could do and be whatever it is I wanted to be in life. And I didn't know that up until that point. So, yeah.
Yeah, and it's interesting because I think that that freedom, that exploration, that sense of, I know my history and I know my strength, gave you that ability to explore this global landscape in a very different way. And I think that's what people want to keep tamped down, is folks not understanding who they are and what their strength is. And so your awareness at 17, reaching back to what happened to you at 6, seemed to have given you all of that for this impact that you've had. Is that why you spend so much time in schools trying to help young people think about their history and learning their stories and being comfortable thinking about issues of race?
Well, you know, when I was asked to write my own story, I thought about that long and hard, because up until that point, I never really thought that I would be an author, even though I was always scribbling in a notebook my thoughts. But when I was asked to tell my story, I thought about it, and I thought, you know, I don't want to just write a book just to be writing. I had to ask myself what was it that I wanted to say, I wanted people to take away from my story. And the only thing that I could think of is I remember wanting to see kids in my classroom every day. Every day when I entered that classroom, I kept hoping and wishing that kids would be there, because that's what any six-year-old would want. And yet they never showed up. And I couldn't understand why I wasn't able to go onto the playground. I couldn't understand why these very tall white men were always on the playground, you know, with yellow bands on their arms, walking around.
The U.S. Marshals.
U.S. Marshals. And I kept thinking to myself, what are they looking for? You know, not realizing that they were there as, you know, to secure the playground. Why couldn't I eat lunch in the cafeteria like all of the other kids? I could smell the food cooking, but I was never allowed to go. And so it was a constant search that year in my own mind as to where the kids were and when they were going to show up and why they were not there. And then it got to the point where I could hear voices of kids. Again, that was very strange. I never saw them, but I could hear them, and no one talked about the voices. I would mention it to my teacher, and she wouldn't really say anything about it. And I realized later that she was constantly going to the principal because the kids were being hidden from me. There were a handful of kids who came to school. They were white, and but the principal would take the kids and she would hide them. So I would never see them, and they would never come in contact with me. But I could hear the voices.
Because some of the whole school, parents were keeping their kids home, but a few were coming. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, that the school emptied out, yet there were a handful of kids who came back to school. And yet when they came back, the principal would take them and she would hide them in another room so that we would never see each other and never come in contact with each other. And so Mrs. Henry, who was my teacher, I later found out that she was going to the principal and saying, you're breaking the law. The law has now changed and kids can be together, but you're hiding them from Ruby. If you don't allow them to come together, I'm going to report you to the superintendent. And so that forced them to allow my teacher to take me to where the kids were. And so I remember that day, you know, walking through this hallway and arriving at a door and my teacher opening the door and walking into a classroom, and there were four or five kids sitting there, and I was so excited. It was like, you know, I knew I heard kids. And truly, it didn't matter to me what they looked like, but I will never forget that day, because I remember encountering a little boy who said, I can't play with you. My mom said not to play with you because you're a nigger. And the minute he said that, it just felt like this huge weight lifted off my tiny shoulders.
What does that mean?
That was my aha moment. You know, he made it all make sense. So all of the questions that I'd had, where are the kids? Why can't I go onto the playground? Why can't I go to the cafeteria? He made it make sense. He told me why, by saying, I can't play with you. And so even though I didn't quite understand racism, I understood the word, and I understood how we were supposed to behave when we were in Mississippi with my grandmother. So when he said it, I definitely knew. But then it just felt like, wow, so that's what this is. That's why there's no kids here. It's because of me. This isn't Mardi Gras. And this isn't college. They're not here because of me. It was like he made it make sense. But then I also remember feeling like I wasn't angry with him, that he said, my mom said not to play with you. And in my tiny six-year-old mind, I thought, well, okay, if my mom or my dad had said, Ruby, don't play with him, he's Hispanic, he's Indian, he's Asian, he's Jewish, mixed race, white, I would not have played with him. So I wasn't angry with him. He hurt my feelings because I wanted to play with kids. But there was a lot more to what he said. And I understood it. And it was okay. And I don't even know if he, I really feel like he wanted to play with us. But he said he couldn't. And so I understood that. At that moment, that was my encounter with racism. It wasn't the crowd outside. It wasn't the fact that this was a white school, because I didn't know that it was a white school. When I went in, everybody left. As far as I'm concerned, it was my school. He made it make sense. And until this very day, it helped me to understand that it is us as adults that keep racism alive. It's not our kids. That each and every one of our children are born with a very special gift, and that is a clean heart and a fresh start in life. It is us as adults that we pass it on, and we use our kids to keep it going. Even the slogan for my foundation is, let's stop using our kids. Racism is a grown-up disease. Let's stop using our kids to spread it. Mm. Because it doesn't matter to kids. It did not. I don't really think it mattered to that little boy. But he explained to me why he couldn't play with me. And I understood it, because I would have done exactly what my parents told me to do at that age. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And there's something profound in a statement you made about, you know, you believed it was your school. When you showed up, the white kids left. Because if we fast forward today and look at William France Elementary School, it's still segregated, but in a different way, right?
Yes, it is now all black. And, you know, that goes against everything that I believe in. Everything that I believed. And I actually fought very hard. I mean, that school was hit by Hurricane Katrina in 2005. And in April of 2005, myself and the Ruby Bridges Foundation, we all fought to put it on the historic registry to save the building, because they were going to tear it down. The enrollment was very, very small, less than 100 kids, I believe. The building was decaying. Again, that part of history was swept under the rug. Nobody particularly cared about it here. And yet I felt a sense of responsibility to save the school. I had had an opportunity to visit Little Rock and saw how they had saved Central High School. And it was a movement that was spearheaded by Bill Clinton, and how it changed the neighborhood and how it became an integrated school all over again. And I thought, well, if it happened there at Little Rock, why can't it happen here in New Orleans? So I started to fight to save it. And sure enough, in August, Hurricane Katrina hit, and it took on about 5 or 6 feet of water, stayed boarded up for almost 4 years or more. But they couldn't tear it down. And so eventually it was restored. The front facade of the building is exactly the way that it was when I went there. And they have since built a whole new building attached to it. But I kept trying to talk to the powers that be because I wanted it to be a charter school that would teach social justice, civil rights, history. And yet, that did not happen. The school was awarded to some other charter school member, and now it's all black. And it definitely goes against what I believe in, because I believe that if we are to ever get past our racial differences, the best place, I mean, I believe that that's going to happen with our young people, and the best place for that to happen is when they're very young and in school together. Now, definitely, I honestly feel like, yes, we as African Americans should have schools that bear our names, schools that we also run as well, but those schools should be integrated too. I think the bigger picture here is that this country will never be united if we, the people, are not united. And we have to start very, very early to work on that, to make that happen.
Ruby, I want to thank you. This has been such a memorable conversation, and I think you've given me and our listeners so much to think about as we all sit on our porches and yes. try to solve big problems in the world. And it's very, you know, moving just really to talk to someone who thinks deeply and acts wisely and who is really walking history. So it's been a pleasure having you here with me on the porch, and I thank you so much.
Thank you. I truly enjoyed stepping back in time and sitting there on the porch, and definitely with you. So hopefully this won't be the last time.
You are always welcome back. We can do some canning and some pea shelling together. So thank you.